Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. 8 days before Christmas, and later this hour, we will have a call in. If you are selling Christmas gifts, if you personally have a small business or a local store, we will open up the phones for you later this hour to plug your wares. Walmart, you're not eligible to call. Target, sorry, you're not eligible to call. But if you are a small business owner or a local store merchant, we will have an open phones for you to promote the Christmas gifts that you are selling coming up later this hour. We'll also take a political and military look at the state of the Afghanistan war coming up. And on our politics website right now, it's afreecountry.org, we have our latest thoroughly unscientific poll. The question is, incoming House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Peter King says he plans to hold hearings on what he calls the radicalization of the Muslim community in this country. So the question is, do you consider this framing fair game for an inquiry, considering the domestic terror plots that have been uncovered, a form of racial profiling or casting suspicion on an entire community for the acts of a very few, or it could be okay or not, depending on how it's done? That's the question. You can read more about politics as well at itsafreecountry.org, our politics website, but you can answer that thoroughly unscientific poll question right now. Our next guest is the last person to represent New York State in the United States Senate who was elected as neither a Democrat nor a Republican. Those of you of a certain age will remember Senator James Buckley, elected on the conservative party line in 1970 when two liberals split the rest of the vote. He was defeated in 1976 after one term by Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He then went on to be a State Department official in the Reagan administration and a federal appeals court judge from 1985 to 2000 when he retired. He is the brother of the late William F. Buckley, and he was the Buckley in Buckley versus Valeo, the 1976 Supreme Court ruling that declared campaign spending is a form of free speech. Now James Buckley has a book. It's mostly a collection of his essays from over the years, with one new essay at the top. It's called Freedom at Risk, Reflections on Politics, Liberty, and the State. Mr. Buckley, thank you so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
I think liberals and conservatives think of different things to an important degree when they each think of freedom, the title of your book, Freedom at Risk. Why did you put that word in your title?
Because we are transforming ourselves into an administrative state, issuing more and more regulations that are throttling our freedom of action. I don't think people realize the extent to which the federal government has been taking over. When I went to law school, there were 3 volumes of federal law. There are now 30 volumes of federal law. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Congress has delegated more and more and more responsibility for issuing marching orders to agencies and bureaus. And we now have 163,000 pages of regulations that have the force of law telling us how to run our lives.
You know, to a liberal, they often roll their eyes when they hear such a lofty ideal as freedom equated with the proliferation of administrative rules in the federal government, or even the right to be free of buying health insurance, the very current example. When there are such repressive governments in the world, like Iran and North Korea, and our last segment was about Russia with a fake judiciary, where people really are not free. The idea of fighting the health insurance mandate, for example, as a fight for essential liberty, the way it's framed, seems overblown to people who are, consider themselves liberal or progressive or sometimes moderate. Are you inflating the meaning of freedom?
I don't think so. I think I'm talking precisely the idea of freedom that motivated the American Revolution, that inspired the people who wrote our Constitution to right into it the concept of federalism, namely the reservation to the states and localities of any responsibility not specifically assigned to Washington. Those people were thinking in terms of freedom as the permitting responsible adults to run their own lives, look after their own futures, take care of their own kids, and find their own means to pursue happiness, without having superior minds looking over their shoulders, telling them how to rule their lives.
Of course, that was a time of an agrarian economy. Things are so different now. And by the 1930s and 40s, FDR had what he called his four freedoms, which included the freedom from want. So is your small government philosophy a protection plan on one level in the contemporary economics that we live within for the guarantee that some people will wind up in a state of want?
No, I don't think there's a total difference between a program making sure that people who are truly down and out have the basic means of sustaining a living and finding some health care, and having the Obamacare, which is telling us in finite detail what an insurance company has to offer you, commanding you to take insurance if you don't want to, telling the medical profession how to run its business. There's a wide gap between a basic safety net and you might call it a welfare state for the middle class.
James Buckley, my guest on WNYC, one-time U.S. Senator from New York, Conservative Party member at that time, brother of William F. Buckley, author now of a book of his collected essays called Freedom at Risk, Reflections on Politics, Liberty, and the State. So to stay on the health care issue for the moment, you were a federal appeals court judge for 15 years. I wonder, as a matter of law, how do you think you would come down on this issue of the health insurance mandate? Can Congress make a law requiring purchase of health insurance by individuals, or do you think you would rule that the Constitution actually prevents it?
One thing you learn when you put on the robe and become a judge is you look at the arguments on both sides. You've got very bright lawyers writing you, giving you one side of the argument, and equally bright lawyers on the other side. I think I can say this, that I believe that the people who wrote the Constitution would be astonished at the idea that the federal government could command you to buy a product under the Commerce Clause. But over the years, the Supreme Court has so expanded that I can't tell you over the phone without having read the arguments whether, given the Supreme Court's decisions, whether the Supreme Court would find that this demand is command was constitutional. I'm not ducking it, but I'm just saying that you ask me what would I do as a judge, I had to follow the orders of the Supreme Court.
That's a very judicious answer. You know, we did a segment earlier in the show about the founders, in fact, ordering people to buy ammunition in the Second Militia Act of 1792, and that perhaps as a constitutional precedent for Congress being able to order Americans to buy health insurance.
Any thought about that?
When
I didn't know that law existed, but was it tested by the Supreme Court?
I don't know, but I believe it stayed on the books until 1903 when it was repealed without a court challenge, I think.
Early Congress also passed the Sedition Act, which was clearly unconstitutional. So I'm not suggesting that early Congresses were less able to act unconstitutionally as recent ones.
Talk about Buckley versus Valeo, the 1976 Supreme Court case that progressive think is one of the worst decisions ever. You got campaign finance spending equated with other forms of free speech. And again, to another way of looking at this, it just gives the wealthy individuals or corporations or unions an unlimited power to overwhelm everyone else's political free speech.
Look, there are people on both sides of every issue that have got a lot of money.
But rarely an equal amount, or frequently not an equivalent amount, correct?
No, I disagree with you. If you're talking about people on both sides of the issues, the Democrats keep on saying that Republicans can, you know, business has all the money. Well, the liberals in this last election round spent a lot more money than conservatives. I'm not afraid of speech.
They spent more money directly, but conservative independent groups under Citizens United spent more money supporting Republican candidates. So I think it breaks down, you could argue it, those two ways.
Yeah. The fact is, as the Supreme Court found in Buckley versus Vallejo, you can't be heard unless you spend money. That's a simple equation in today's world. And the effect of trying to, well, the Supreme Court did say in that case that it was constitutional to place a limit on how much an individual could give. The effect of that decision, that finding, was that you transferred power from individuals to PACs. And PACs have a very definite point of view, and they're the ones that are going to be asking our members of Congress to vote one way or another. So that you've distorted the whole process. But I don't see where we have to fear speech as speech.
Have we wound up all these years since Buckley versus Vallejo about where you might have predicted or hoped after that ruling with respect to campaign finance?
No, I think we have to undo the limits on individuals and restore true freedom to individuals. The Supreme Court's justified that particular restriction on the basis that it led to corruption. Well, in my experience, individuals support people they believe in. They're not going to give them marching orders and to vote this way or that way on this issue or the other. But once you get unions, once you get corporations into the act, once you make them the principal sources of financing, then you raise those possibilities. But in the last analysis, I think the distortions created by the attempt to limit what individuals can do to support people they want to support is distortions that have made money, the search for money, one of the real headaches for people in public office.
Are you a fan of the Citizens United ruling?
Yes, I am.
You write against judicial activism in your book, and some people say that was a classic case of judicial activism from the right, in part because all that was really before the court was a limited question of this particular anti-Hillary Clinton documentary that was going to air on cable television, and the court sent it back to the lower court to be argued on a broader basis, which allowed the Supreme Court to then unregulate all independent spending on campaigns. Is that not the definition of an activist court?
No. It's not my definition. My definition of judicial activism is when a judge will distort the clear meaning and understanding of the people who created a law in order to achieve political objectives that are unrelated to what the law is about. A distortion of the law, and I believe that in Citizens United, the Supreme Court accurately defined what freedom of speech implies.
That's an interesting definition of judicial activism. Some people have defined it to include a court's willingness to overturn an act of Congress, or at the state level, a court's willingness to overturn an act of the legislature, because the judicial branch is being activist, you know, with respect to the legislative branch. Do you not see it that way?
The court has the obligation under the Constitution to determine what is constitutional. So I don't see any conflict there. What I, at least in my mind, I've always dissociated activism with this idea that the Constitution is a living document that you have to update by reflecting new ideas and so on.
James Buckley, my guest on WNYC for another few minutes, his collection of his essays, Freedom at Risk, Reflections on Politics, Liberty, and the State. I noticed that some of your essays are on the environment, and I was surprised to see that you were for the Endangered Species Act in the 1970s and even defended the stopping of big developments to protect the insignificant fish known as the snail darter, which at the time, you know, was not seen as a conservative position, and conservatives were deriding protecting something as ecologically insignificant as the snail darter for stopping progress and economic development over that. Was this an exception to your usual politics?
No. read that essay carefully. Conservatives are loath to upset nature unless there's a good reason to do it. And in that article, I did point out that Congress had amended the law to allow it to be overridden by a commission where you had an important issue at stake. Incidentally, the snail darter was blocking something called the Tellico Dam, which would have created yet another lake in Tennessee for recreational purposes, and would have destroyed the last stretch of free-flowing river in the state for no economic gain, no significant economic gain at all. So it was...
That was a government project, correct?
That was a government project.
And
yeah.
did you hold the same position when it came to the balance between environmental protection and private economy development?
Yes, I did. Following my love story with the Endangered Species Act, was an article on regulation in which I said the EPA ought to balance costs against benefits, something that it does far too rarely, I'm afraid.
So does your position on that call into question your fundamental notion of economic freedom always leading to good outcomes? If the unregulated market will destroy the environment too much, why not think that government has to manage the economy to protect other things and people that we see as important in a society? The market, you know, not to argue for some kind of Soviet marketplace, but that it doesn't protect all Americans and so needs to be managed by the government.
Don't forget the Endangered Species Act, as originally understood, was a restraint on federal action. So I'm saying this is a government, keep your hands off unless there is a clear, overwhelming benefit. And part of the argument for the Endangered Species Act is that we don't know what biological entity, a plant, an animal, and so on, has huge value for humanity. These things haven't been tested out. There's a huge reservoir of potential wealth out there. And once you destroy a species, you can't recreate it.
You were a critic of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs in the 1960s. I don't know exactly what you were saying about Medicare when it was created, but do you look back at that now and say we should not have Medicaid and Medicare, that was a mistake from the beginning?
Medicare, I'd back away from. Medicaid is fits in with dealing with people who are destitute, who don't have the means of getting the fundamental medicine they need. When Medicare is available to people in their later years, I would rather have a system which, knows. I was looking after my own health till I turned 65. I was paying my own premiums for insurance policies that I decided covered the grounds that I wanted to cover. And it seems to me that I didn't need government to come in when I turned 65 to look after me. Now,
the marketplace could provide health care or health insurance for people who are so statistically likely to need expensive care because of their age?
My belief is that if you had a free market in medical insurance, which we do not have, given competition, that I could have bought a policy in my 30s, 40s, and 50s that I could keep for the rest of my life. And it would provide me with a range of care that I would need.
You think the marketplace would let you buy a policy at 35 that you could keep when you were 85?
Yeah.
Why would they sell such a policy?
To make money. To have a large enough pool. They'd be offering something the next guy wouldn't.
Last question. You were U.S. Senator from New York for a while. Why do you think the Empire State seems so immune to the conservative wave that has gradually swept the rest of the country since your day?
Because they lost me. How's that?
Anything to add to that?
There's interesting phenomenon. I live in Connecticut now, one of the top per capita states, like New York, per capita income, run by people who come out of universities who think they know best how to manage other people's lives. So you have the richest states with the worst economic problems among the 50 states. It seems to me that tells us something about the philosophy that has taken charge in government rather than endemic problems that can't be solved.
Former U.S. Senator, former Federal Appeals Court Judge James Buckley, now the author of Freedom at Risk, Reflections on Politics, Liberty, and the State. I really appreciate the conversation.
Thanks so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we'll take a look at the progress report given by President Obama yesterday on the one-year anniversary of the Afghanistan troop surge, politics, and the military state of the war. And then if you personally are selling Christmas gifts, if you have a small business or a local store, we'll have an open phones for you to plug your wares. Stay with us.